Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to an alumnus, or alumna, from the University of Texas at El Paso, Dr. Jennifer Ricker. She's at the University of Colorado Medical Center, the so-called Anschutz Medical Center, up there in Denver, or a suburb of Denver. And Jennifer, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Before we get into what you do, and I should now mention then that Jennifer is an authority in researching things like breast cancer and the hormonal aspects of breast cancer. But before we get to that, tell us, how did you become a scientist? What were those developing moments when you suddenly said, ha, 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 this is interesting?
Well, I think I always knew, even when I was a little kid, that I loved nature and I loved to learn anything about how living organisms worked. And so I always thought I would go into some aspect of biology, but I didn't know exactly what. But I was one of these kids that collected tadpoles to watch them turn into frogs and collected different types of moss when I would be camping and just loved nature. And as I got older, you know, I think the things that kids are exposed to, they see their medical doctors, right? But they don't always meet researchers. So, and
well, very seldom do.
Right. So I thought, oh, I'll be an MD or I'll be a veterinarian and, you know, work at a zoo or something like that. So I majored in biology. I always knew that I was going to do some type of biology. But then as I got further along in a pre-med program, I was approached by one of my professors and she sort of introduced me to the concept of doing research. And then when I found out that they would pay me to go to graduate school instead of me going into debt to go to medical school. And I worked with my uncle, who was an MD, a OBGYN.
Oh, so you had somebody in the family.
Yeah, so I saw him delivering babies and working all night. And I thought, well, that's you know, fun, but it's a tough life. And it's kind of ends up being routine. You know, most MDs, medical doctors, do the same thing over and over again, really. And they do things by the book. And then I worked for a veterinarian as well and saw that that could be disheartening. You know, some people love their pets, but others don't and think that they're replaceable. So as I was introduced to the concept of research, I realized these are the people on the cutting edge. These are the people that are learning new things and figuring out what protocols the MDs should follow, what new treatments people should be given. And this is the place where new discoveries are being made. You know, you're looking under the microscope. You might even be able to name a new parasite for yourself.
Or same idea with an amateur astronomer. They may see something up there that
planet,
no one's seen
new
before.
Star,
Right? Well, that's lovely. Let's go back for a minute, though. When you were collecting all these tadpoles and watching wonderful transformations and bringing them home, your parents were pretty supportive? You didn't have any mishaps?
Yeah, I'm sure we had a few mishaps. And my son is the same way. So all over my house, we have jars with different interesting specimens or concoctions. And one of his leeches escaped a couple of years ago and traveled around the house for a while. Yes, a big leech. So my son has a lot of mishaps now. And whenever we see a pond, he says, stop the car. I have to collect some water and look at that under the microscope. So he apparently inherited this gene.
Oh. Tell me about leeches. It's not a word that people use in a positive sense very much. You know, oh, he's a leech, she's a leech. You know, and the whole idea of old medicine was, well, if you can't think of anything else, put leeches all over to suck away the blood.
Right. What, that's
tell us a little bit about.
They are blood-sucking organisms.
Right.
And in medicine, they used to use them too because they thought when people became sick that it was bad blood and they needed to suck out all that bad blood, so they would bring in the leeches. And actually, they are still used sometimes in medicine.
Well,
that's a whole separate topic.
Well, I know it is, but I'm sort of intrigued by it because, you know, I've got some friends who believe in folk medicine and, you know, they say, oh, well, the ancients have always found ways to sort of concoct something of interest. And here you have leeches. It sounds barbaric, medieval, and it probably was, but why is it still in use?
Well, they can clean up the debris, basically, so necrotic tissue. I think that's what they can do. And they also, you know, getting the blood flowing again by sucking on it. So there's something to be said for that.
Is there a special genus of leech that's particularly
valued? Well, now they're grown. Now they're grown in a sterile environment. They don't just go out and catch them, the ones that they use in medicine. But they do. They are still used.
That's interesting.
So the ancient people knew what they were doing.
We've progressed anyway. So, and now you went away and studied. You studied a master's degree here at UT El Paso.
I got a bachelor's and a master's
right.
at UTEP.
What did you do for your research for the master's degree?
So Dr. Lillian Mayberry and Jack Bristol were the professors that sort of introduced me to research and said, you don't want to go to medical school. You want to do the interesting stuff. And it was actually in a place called Puerto Peñasco.
Oh, right, that, down in Mexico.
Lillian Mayberry cornered me in a place that I could not get away from her. And these were these open toilets that they had there where you would actually be sitting on the toilet and be able to have a conversation with each other.
Oh, well. And if you didn't agree to go back and do research with her, the bus would leave early and there you would be.
Leave you there.
Stuck in a latrine in Puerto
Peñasco. So she told me, you know, we're the ones that are doing the cutting edge, interesting science. And why do you want to go to medical school? And I told her why I thought I wanted to go to medical school. But the more we talked about it, the more I realized this sounds interesting. And my stepfather here in El Paso, he had worked at White Sands Missile Range for a long time. And he spent, about 7 years working on a doctorate degree at Vanderbilt. And he said, well, you know, if you think you want to go into research, you should do a master's and make sure that you like research because it can be a long haul.
Right.
And so I took his advice and stayed on with Jack and Lillian, the Mayberry-Bristol team, for another year and a half and got a master's and found out that I really did like research. It's just addictive, you know, knowing that you're the one that's at the cutting edge and making discoveries that nobody else in the world has made is such an exciting concept. No,
absolutely. I mean, you know, you have a student and they make a new molecule and they don't really realize this until you point out that, you know, the world supply of this unusual material is in their hands and they made it.
Right.
But tell us, what did you do in this? Because they're parasitologists.
Right. So I worked on protozoans that live in the gut of various organisms. And I also took a class with Dr. Judy Elsie.
All right.
And she was in the biology department. Her husband's in chemistry, as you know,
absolutely.
Although they're both retired now. But she was really influential, too, because she taught me how to use the electron microscope and take beautiful pictures of these parasites that I would then give to my mother and she would put on her refrigerator.
to keep her from eating too much, right?
So, yeah, just studying the whole relationship between these parasites and the host organism, being a human or another mammal, and then the vectors that the parasites somehow often need to go through, and the whole relationship between the parasite and the different vectors, and the insect vector, the mammalian vector, and these life cycles were just fascinating.
Did you have to go out and collect these parasites, or were they already provided for you?
We did not at that time, but later on, after I did, when I finished my doctorate degree, where I studied actually dog heartworm because it's related to
dog heartworms.
Heartworms, yes.
Fascinating.
And they are related to the human parasite that causes elephantiasis. And so I got to go, as I was telling you, to some fascinating places to travel, like the French Polynesia and all these little islands around Tahiti. And we were studying these filariid worms that cause elephantiasis in humans. And they're related, like I was saying, to dog heartworm. But as I was telling you earlier, when you go to these tropical places, you go to study one parasite and often come back with a different parasite or more than one. And when I was there in graduate school, I got dengue fever, which is a very bad and unpleasant virus.
Yeah, so when you say you go to collect one and come back with another,
exactly.
It's totally fortuitous. You went to collect one in a container, and the other one you got
came back in your blood.
That's wonderful. So that's what you did for you did go to Vanderbilt in the end?
Oh, no. So after UTEP, I went up to University of Colorado, or actually Colorado State University, in Fort Collins for my doctorate degree.
Okay.
And there I studied dog heartworm and these parasites that cause elephantiasis in humans. And then I did a postdoctoral fellowship in Boston at New England Biolabs because they have a – at the time, I wanted to see what it was like to work in industry and do research in industry. And they had – one of the founders of that company had a philanthropic interest in parasites like malaria and these filarid parasites that cause elephantiasis. And so he had – they had their money-making, profit-making restriction enzymes and tools for molecular biology, but they also had a division that did basic research and studied parasites.
Okay. So, I mean, parasites and Jennifer Riker are sort of just
my beginnings.
Intertwined.
That's right.
Right. Yes.
Symbiotic relationship.
I mean –
instead
it
of
sounds
a parasitic
to someone like me, you know, dog heartworms. I mean, you know, it's quite grim. But that's not what you've landed up doing as a career.
Right. So
you're now at the medical school as a faculty member, and you're doing research on breast cancer. Let's talk about how did you segue from heartworms to breast cancer.
So in my postdoctoral fellowship at New England Biolabs, we were studying hormones. And our theory was that one of the reasons these worms needed to go through an insect vector was that perhaps the larval stages of the worms had hormone receptors that were responding to an insect hormone, which is actually one of the first hormones ever discovered called ecdysone. And we thought maybe these worms had primitive receptors for this hormone. And so my project was to clone the receptors from the parasitic nematodes that were responding to the insect hormone. And so at the molecular level, these hormone receptors have evolved to all be very similar. They have a hormone binding domain, and they also have a DNA binding domain, and that's how they have these zinc fingers that bind to
the famous zinc fingers.
Yes, and so there's
always a metal at the heart of so much biochemistry.
We're getting right to the chemistry, right? So they can bind to DNA and turn off – they act as transcription factors, and they turn on and off a whole bunch of other genes. So basically, it's a way for environmental cues, the hormones, to control genes at the molecular level. So I realized when I was doing a postdoctoral fellowship at a company that I sort of missed the academic environment. I wrote to a woman who was doing breast cancer research at the University of Colorado, Dr. Kate Horowitz. I had met her at meetings, and she always had a big gaggle of graduate students and postdocs with her, and she was doing very interesting work on estrogen and progesterone receptors. So I wrote to her and said, I'm doing research on hormone receptors in worms. Can I come work in your laboratory?
And the answer was yes.
And the answer was yes. Come out for an interview. And yeah, it all started there.
And that's one of the things that people who go into science don't recognize at the beginning, but soon learn. And that is networking. You go to meetings, you meet people, you see if they're doing interesting science. You also see if they look like they're interesting people. I mean, there's a certain aspect to this.
Right, because getting a doctorate
contact
and your postdoctoral fellowship, it can be a long-term relationship.
Right.
So you want to pick people who also have an interest in training other people.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Riker. She's from the University of Colorado and Schutz Medical Center. And we're talking about parasites. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Dr. Jennifer Riker from the University of Colorado and Schutz Medical Center. And we've been discussing heartworms, parasites, but leading into a career in breast cancer, as it turns out. Jennifer, before we get on to what you're doing now and the importance of hormones in some aspects of breast cancer, can we give the audience a sort of a hormone 101? What is a hormone? Where does it come from? Where do we make them in our body? And what's their big role? Just relatively short, but just to put it, because a lot of people know the word, but they really don't know what they are.
Okay. Hormones are made by endocrine glands. So these are substances that are derived from cholesterol, and they're made in all different glands in the body as a way to communicate to distant tissues a signal. So, for instance, you have the pituitary, the thymus, the uterus and the ovaries, and the prostate in men. So all of these glands can make hormones and secrete them into the bloodstream to tell other tissues what to do, to give them signals. And then the other tissues and cells have receptors for the hormones that can receive the signal. And these receptors go into the nucleus, so the hormone is soluble and it can diffuse across the membrane of cells and bind to the receptor in the cytoplasm of the cell and move into the nucleus where they do their business.
Okay, so
that's where they can transcribe lots of other genes and tell the cell whether it should divide and keep growing or stop growing or differentiate. For instance, in the breast or the mammary gland, the ultimate differentiative function is lactation or nursing in the mammalian organisms. So these hormones, in the case of estrogen and progesterone, the female sex steroids, they're made in the ovary, but they can travel through the blood and tell the breast what to do.
Can they travel to other parts of the female anatomy? And also, I mean, obviously they must, do they cross the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain and make changes happen there?
Yes, even astrocytes in the brain have
the
estrogen, neurons in the brain have estrogen receptors. So you're right. A lot of cognitive function, a lot of the way the heart functions, the uterus, so the lining of the uterus responds to estrogen and progesterone. So yeah, basically all these other organs, they do what they do in response to the female hormones that are made in the ovary.
So that then makes me understand a little better now about why they will have a role in breast cancer, because one tends to think of a cancer cell as, you know, some DNA has been fouled up, screwed up, and that's giving rise to an inappropriate cell growth, etc. But you're implying, and I may be totally wrong, that you know, hormones can start giving signals to differentiate activity of cells in the breast.
Or to proliferate or keep dividing inappropriately.
Right. Yeah. So carry on with that idea, because that's not something I think a lot of people know. I certainly don't know anything about it.
Right. So say in men, prostate cancer is driven by testosterone and other androgens. So what happens is cancer is initiated by a mutation. And it can be in various different genes, but often in DNA repair genes. And the more often a cell divides, it has to replicate the DNA, and so there's more chance to make a mistake. So these DNA repair enzymes can go in and fix these random mistakes. But if you get a mutation in the DNA repair gene, like BRCA1 is one that is associated with breast cancer, but only about 5% of breast cancers involve a mutation in this DNA repair gene, BRCA1. But then what happens is those cells start to divide inappropriately and they propagate the mistake. But the uncontrollable propagation or division and multiplication of these cells is dependent on the hormonal signal to divide. So basically, and there's also an anti-apoptotic or anti-cell death signal that hormones can provide. And so those cells stay alive inappropriately.
So apoptosis is a sort of
cell death.
Cell death by sort of suicide.
Self-destruction.
I mean, it's built in. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So the hormones and the hormone receptors can keep the cells alive inappropriately. So these cancer cells are rapidly dividing, and they're not differentiating to do what they're supposed to do in the normal body. For instance, in breast, the ultimate function, as I was saying, is lactation or milk secretion. But the cancer cells, instead of responding appropriately to hormonal cues, and often these cells, typically with every menstrual cycle in the breast and the uterus, the cells, you know, undergo proliferation, but then they self-destruct with every cycle. But when they have a genetic mutation in a DNA repair enzyme, such as P53 or BRCA1, they start dividing inappropriately, and then the hormones and the hormone receptors keep them alive, and then the tumor becomes dependent or addicted to these hormones. And that's why you can come in with an anti-hormone and use that as a therapy to treat cancer.
Now, speaking personally, that's the first time I've heard someone sort of run through this sort of picture of breast cancer, for example. How long have we known all that? I mean, if you'd been here 20 years ago, would you have been able to make that same three-minute statement?
No, and I actually, the interesting thing is probably in about the 20s, it was farmers, and then some of the surgeons in England were farmers as well. And they noticed that when they castrated certain animals, say, for instance, oophorectomy, taking out the ovaries in sheep, that the mammary glands, or the breasts, essentially, would regress. So they first started putting together the idea that there was a Dr. Beetson, and first started noticing that the ovaries must be making some substance that was affecting a distant organ like the mammary glands. And then later on, it wasn't until, probably the 70s and 80s that they started having a molecular cloning of these receptors.
Right.
But they knew before that there was some secreted substance.
So then, I mean, that leads to the question. You're well-funded by the National Institutes of Health, and a lot of people are. The goal of the National Institutes of Health is to improve, maintain, and improve the health of the nation. So this understanding that you've just gone through of all these communications resulting in the inability of cells to undergo apoptosis, for example, how does that impact, as you see your vision, treatment of breast cancer or prevention of breast cancer?
So one of the earliest therapies for cancers were chemotherapies. And some of these drugs were used in warfare, chemical warfare. But some scientists, pathologists, noticed that under the microscope that these drugs were killing cells, especially the cells that were rapidly dividing. And so they started trying them in cancer patients. And there's a very nice review of all this in a book called The Emperor of All Maladies. It's a great book about the history of cancer treatments. Basically, the first treatments were these chemotherapies, and they would just kill all the rapidly dividing cells. And since the cancer cells are usually rapidly dividing, not always, and not all of the cancer cells, for instance, the cancer stem cells are not rapidly dividing, and those are the ones that can come back. But the bulk of the cancer cells are turning over fairly quickly. But the chemotherapies, the upside is they often do kill the bulk of the tumors and put the person into remission. But the bad part is that some of the cells can linger and come back years later. And also the side effects, the immediate side effects, are that it kills the other rapidly dividing cells.
Collateral damage.
Right. So the hair follicles are rapidly dividing. The epithelial lining of the intestine, those are rapidly dividing cells. So that's why patients get nausea. Oh. And so there's a lot of downsides to chemotherapy, even though they're very powerful drugs. Next to surgery and actually removing cancer, this is really what cures a lot of patients. However, they can also damage cells, and that can lead to other cancers later on, way down the road, 20 years later sometimes. So the goal now is, with precision medicine, you hear this term, and personalized medicine, is to use targeted therapies, which are trying to target the tumor cells uniquely and not kill the normal cells so that the patient doesn't have as many side effects. So the targeted therapies are against things that the cancer cells make too much of. These cancer cells are all derived from normal cells in our body. So it's a little bit hard, unlike with the parasite situation where that's a foreign organism. These are cells that were derived from our self, essentially. However, they start to make new mutated proteins and also an overabundance of certain proteins, like growth factor receptors, on the surface of the tumor. So the targeted therapies are going after those things that the tumor cells are making uniquely and trying to avoid killing the normal cells.
The other cells.
And these hormonal therapies that I work on are going after the hormone
the messenger.
Receptors. Yeah, the
right.
messenger.
So
and
in this case,
it's
not just the message, but you want the messenger.
Right.
It's a slight different take on an old phrase. This is fascinating and absolutely, I'm learning a lot. But let's just change a little bit because we've got a couple of minutes left. I know, because we've had conversations before, that you sometimes go out to talk to undergraduates who are not really certain about anything, about what you do. And you've got this interesting story that you were telling me earlier. I'd like you to repeat.
Well, when I was a postdoctoral fellow in industry, as I told you, the company that I worked for had a Nobel Prize winner who had won the prize for RNA splicing. So we had some visitors that were elementary school kids. I think they were fourth or fifth grade. And they came to the company, and various people that worked there were giving lectures. So the Nobel Prize winner was giving his lecture about RNA splicing to these children. And, of course, they were very honored to meet a Nobel Prize winner, but they weren't understanding a word that he said, unfortunately, because he jumped right into the very technical aspect of what he was doing. So I was supposed to give my talk right after his, and I, sort of knowing children maybe a little bit better, I came in with a big jar of worms, a dog heart with worms coming out of it.
The actual heart,
yes,
with the worms in there.
Formaldehyde-fixed
right.
Heart with worms coming out of it, and a big diagram of the life cycle of these worms where they have to go through a mosquito that bites the dog, etc. So the kids kind of woke up and got excited. And the letters that they wrote back to thank us for the tour of the company and the lectures, you know, they all wrote that they were so honored to meet a Nobel Prize winner, but they really liked that worm lady.
Well,
and that taught me a lesson about knowing your audience and being able to communicate what you do.
Absolutely correct, Jennifer Ricker. It's been delightful having you here on the on Science Studio. And so, in fact, I'd like to thank Dr. Jennifer Ricker from the University of Colorado and Schutz Medical Center. Fascinating program. Thank you very much. And Norma Martinez, thank you, as always, for keeping us straight. And to the audience, we'll be back next week with another riveting program. Take care.